With land, they managed to do it. With personal property, why, that was a different sort of thing. But a good example of a pledge is when you have to go to benevolent Uncle Ben and borrow 5% of the value of the family silverware at 42% a year interest. So they had pledges in those days too. Now Deuteronomy 24 verses 6 brings out something. What could you take from a poor man? The man with lots of belongings so that he could let you take possession of some of them without any particular trouble to himself, he probably didn't have to borrow anyway. The poor man who had nothing but what was essential to his living, he was the one who had to borrow. Now in those days, you didn't go down to the corner grocery and buy a sack of flour from which all the real food value has been processed out. You had your own wheat stored in the whole grain and your own little stone mill with which you ground it. And some creditors would take one of the millstones for a pledge. So that was forbidden. No man shall take the nether or the upper millstone to pledge, for he takes a man's life to pledge. You can't bake bread out of unbroken whole grain. It has to be ground into flour. And bread was an extremely important part of their diet. Then a man wants to borrow from you, and he offers to give you something as a pledge. And, well, if he hasn't got any more than that, all right, I'll lend it on that. Now, can you go into his house and see whether there's anything more that you might also demand as a pledge? Nope. Forbidden. Deuteronomy 24, verses 10 to 11. And when thou dost lend thy brother anything, thou shalt not go into his house to fetch the pledge. Thou shalt stand abroad, and the man to whom thou dost lend shall bring out the pledge unto thee. And if the man be poor, thou shalt not sleep with his pledge. In any case, thou shalt deliver him the pledge again when the sun goeth down, that he may sleep in his own raiment and bless thee, and it shall be righteousness unto thee before Yahweh thy God. Many times, the man's cloak was the only thing he had to offer as a pledge. And probably he didn't have sufficient blankets in his home to sleep under just those. He had to have that cloak also for sufficient warmth to sleep. So God was looking after these details. Well, a loan has been made, and the debtor, crying honestly, just simply can't pay it all. Now what? Well, Deuteronomy 15, verses 1 to 4, gives us the rule for the year of release, every seventh year. At the end of every 7 years, thou shalt make a release. Now that doesn't mean 7 years after whenever you loaned the money. The year of release came at regular intervals, just as our presidential election comes at 4-year intervals. You might make the loan when it was 6.5 years until the next year of release, or you might make the loan when it was 18 days until the next year of release. The year of release came always on this 7-year rhythm. And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor that lendeth aught to his neighbor shall release it. He shall not exact it of his neighbor or of his brother, because it is called Yahweh's release. Of a foreigner thou mayest exact it again, but that which is thine with thy brother, thine hand shall release, save where there be no poor among you. For Yahweh shall greatly bless thee in the land, which Yahweh thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it. In other words, if everybody, without exception, in the whole nation of Israel had followed all of God's laws, everything would have been so good there would have been no poor. There would have been nobody who had to make desperate loans of this sort to survive. And so in that case, there'd be no need of the year of release because he'd be able to repay it. But as long as there are any poor in the land, you have to have this year of release. And you remember, Jesus Christ reminded them, the poor ye have always with you. Now, we haven't been willing to follow that. God promised Israel that if they would voluntarily cancel these loans, instead of trying to get the last 32 cents out of some poor bankrupt debtor, that he would give them such prosperity that they would be much better off than if they had collected the last few copper coins they could get out of it. Well, I haven't bothered keeping my statistics up to date all the time, but note how regularly what we used to call panics and then depressions and so forth have occurred on a seven-year rhythm. 1893, 1900, 1907. The next one was due for its worst in 1914, but it was already terribly bad in 1913. By 1914, the artificial war prosperity that we were selling the British and the French war materials at inflated prices, that pulled us temporarily out of the depression. 1921 came again right on schedule. 1928 brought the beginnings of the crash in Europe. We kidded ourselves out of it until 1929, when we couldn't convince ourselves by our own lies that we were prosperous. 1935, sure, we were in the midst of the permanent depression that started under Roosevelt, but it was a little deeper in 35. 1942, it was due again. But again, we have the artificial war prosperity. We were spending ourselves rich. 1949, again, there was a dip. 1956, another low spot. 1963, things were bad. 1970, what happened to all our manufacturing industry along the Pacific Coast, for example? How many men have been out of work since 1970? This thing has been hitting on a reliable seven-year rhythm, and that's why God made the seventh year the year of release. If you won't live up to his law, you can't stave off the consequences beyond 7 years. So we've been following it the hard way and not getting any of the benefits. If we did it God's way, he said we'd have prosperity. Now, one more thing. Any of you who've made your living on a farm know that it's hard work. It's a lot easier to sit behind a desk and make marks with a pencil on a piece of paper. But this seventh year of release was also a year of rest. No crops were to be sown, nothing to be harvested. God said, if you follow this law, I will give you such bountiful crops that when you get in your sixth year's harvest, you will have enough to feed you through the seventh year of release and rest, and through the eighth year when you sow your new crops, and on into the ninth year when you reap them. Well, seven of these seven-year periods add up to 49, don't they? Then when you came to the 50th year, you had one more thing. You had the Jubilee. Now, if you simply borrowed money and couldn't repay it, the seventh year of release canceled the debt. But suppose now you'd gotten hard up, which farmers customarily do, And you'd had to sell the farm for what you could get. Or you mortgaged it and you lost it on foreclosure. Now the seventh year of release did not bring you back your mortgaged or sold farm. It was only the 50th year, the Jubilee, that brought it back to you. In other words, you could not, no matter what kind of a document you signed, you could not sell the family homestead for longer than the period till the next Jubilee year. Maybe 50 years, maybe 2 months. It came on its regular rhythm. But the right to occupy the land, to harvest the crops, to get the profit of it, until the next Jubilee, that was all you were able to either mortgage or sell. Now, I don't need to tell you in detail about the decay and fall of Rome. In the early days of the Republic, when the Romans were a nation of sturdy, independent farmers, they were a tough bunch. They not only defended their own homeland successfully against invasion, but they went out and conquered all the world they knew about. Then the inevitable occurred, if you're not living under God's laws. There always comes a year of poor crops sometime or another, insect plague, drought or something. And the way things are organized, except under the laws of God, the farmer can't get along without his current year's income. He's never able to get enough ahead to carry him through a bad year. So he mortgages his farm and loses it, or he sells it for what pitifully small sum he can get. And then all he can do is go to the city and become part of the city rabble that was the downfall of Rome. When he owned his own land, he was a free man. He earned his own living. He owned his own home. He had something to fight for. And woe to the man who tried to take it from him. But you know what Rome became. These beggared mobs demanding bread and circuses. What have they to fight for? What could any invader take away from them? Their poverty? That's all they had. And Rome reached the point where Rome couldn't raise an army of Romans to defend the city. They had to depend entirely upon hiring what they called the barbarians, who were the first wave of the advancing Israelite tribes coming out of Germany. They had to depend upon them to defend Rome. And when these so-called barbarians saw that there wasn't much point in trying to defend the degenerate people of Rome, that was the end of Rome. Now that's the thing that God's law intended to prevent. Here's the rule of the Jubilee, Leviticus 25, verses 8 to 23. And thou shalt number 7 Sabbaths of years unto thee, 7 times 7 years, and the space of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be unto thee 49 years. Thou shalt cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month in the Day of Atonement. You shall make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. And you shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. And you remember, we call our much treasured bell the Liberty Bell because cast in the rim of that bell are those words, proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a jubilee unto you, and you shall return every man unto his possession. And ye shall return every man unto his family. A jubilee shall that 50th year be unto you. Ye shall not sow, neither reap that which grows of itself in it, neither gather the grapes in it of thy vine undressed, for it is the jubilee. It shall be holy unto you. In the year of the Jubilee ye shall return every man unto his possession. And if thou sell anything unto thy neighbor, or buyest any of thy neighbor's land, ye shall not oppress one another. According to the number of the years after the Jubilee shalt thou buy of thy neighbor, and according to the number of years of the fruit he shall sell unto thee. According to the multitude of years shalt thou increase the price thereof, and according to the fewness of years thou shalt diminish the price of it. For according to the number of years of the fruit doth he sell unto thee. Ye shall not therefore oppress one another, but shall fear thy God, for I, Yahweh, am your God. The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, and ye are strangers and sojourners with me. And you've been sitting here wondering, now, every seventh year the farmer doesn't sow or reap any crop. And the 49th and the 50th years both, he doesn't sow or reap any crop. Now what about that? What's the idea of that? What is the condition of the people who are raising cotton and the people who are raising wheat in this country today? Now, if a man's afraid of hard work, he doesn't become a farmer. And if he is a farmer, he likes to produce all his land will produce, and he tries to get a big crop. And we have produced surpluses beyond what the current demand can cover, and so they are bought by subsidy from the government and stored up. And now either that is a useless burden on the taxpayer forever, or else when that stored up surplus is sold, what market is there for the farmer's current crop? And the way we run it now, unless he can sell a crop every year, he's out of luck. But remember now that seventh year and the 50th year, that used up these excessive surpluses. So when the next crop came in after that, the farmer had a market for it. Now there was enough surplus on hand that nobody need fear going hungry on the seventh or the 50th years. But there was not an unmanageable surplus that simply wrecked the thing economically for everybody. God's law took care of that. Now what about taxation? Under God's law, an income tax is the only tax permissible. Now as it stands today, all the time that you are gainfully employed, you are taxed grossly excessively so that you have little chance to lay aside much to live on in your old age. And when you reach the point where you can't work and you have to retire and your Social Security is not enough to live on and pay taxes both, then you lose your home. It's confiscated by taxation, which I don't need to argue the point, is a totally evil system. And under God's law, it couldn't occur. When you have a big income, you can pay a big tax. When you have a little income, you only pay a little tax. And when you have no income, you don't pay any tax at all. Now, originally, the Levites made up the entire civil government. Of the tribe of Levi, the family of Aaron were on duty constantly at the temple. They carried out the priestly duties there. Then the rest of the tribe, while they came every 6 months for a couple of weeks' tour of duty at the temple, the rest of the time they were scattered throughout the land. In the territory of every one of the landed tribes of Israel, there were certain small villages given to the Levites, and beyond that, you had individual Levites residing in other cities. Now they were there to be the teachers. They were there to be the judges. They were there to be the administrators. They were the entire civil government. So, for that, a tax of a tithe was levied. Remember, all the other tribes were given territorial areas, and they were to support themselves. Now, farming is a full-time job, as those of you who have tried it may learn. And a Levite who had to keep himself up to date on the law of God by constant study, I don't mean that it changed, but I mean he had to make sure he didn't forget it. He couldn't do that in such odds and ends of time as farming allowed him. So his job in the civil service was a full-time job, and he was not to earn his living by farming. Numbers 18, verses 20 and 21 and 24 to 28. And Yahweh spoke unto Aaron and said, Thou shalt have no inheritance in their land, neither shalt thou have any part among them. I am thy part and thine inheritance among the children of Israel. And behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tenth in Israel for an inheritance. But the tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer as the heave offering unto Yahweh, I have given to the Levites to inherit. Therefore I have said unto them, Among the children of Israel they shall have no inheritance. And Yahweh spoke unto Moses, saying, Thus speak unto the Levites, and say unto them, When ye take of the children of Israel the tithes which I have given you from them for your inheritance, then ye shall offer up an heave offering of it for Yahweh, even a tenth part of the tithe. And this your heave offering shall be reckoned unto you as though it were the corn of your threshing floor and the fullness of your winepress. And ye shall give thereof Yahweh's heave offering to Aaron the priest. So the total governmental tax was 10%, not of your gross, but of your net. That is, it recognized that there was some cost to operating your farm. It was your increase at the end of the year. You started with 100 cattle at the beginning of the year, and you had 128 at the end of the year, so 28 was your increase. Now, you sowed your fields with grain. From what you reaped, you had to set aside enough for seed grain for the next sowing, and the remainder over that was your increase. And so a tenth part of your increase was paid, nine-tenths of which went for the general civil government, and one-tenth of it for the strictly priestly functions at the temple. Now there was one more thing, the matter of public charity. And I needn't remind you how many billions of dollars per year we are spending today on welfare, subsidizing the raising of a crop of bastard children. That's the most profitable thing some of these people can do. Deuteronomy 14, verses 28 to 29, and see also Deuteronomy 26, verses 12 to 14. At the end of 3 years, thou shalt bring forth all the tithe of thine increase the same year, and shall lay it up within thy gates. And the stranger and the fatherless and the widow which are within thy gates shall come and shall eat and be satisfied, that Yahweh thy God may bless thee in all the work of thine hand which thou doest. So, 10% to run the general government, 3 1/3% a year for public charity, and that was your total tax. Now, no nation in history has long survived after taxation reached or passed the point of 30% of the total national income, what we call the gross national product. And our taxation now is at approximately the 35% level. Some of it you recognize, your federal and state income tax, your state sales tax, and the federal and state gasoline taxes. But there are an awful lot of hidden taxes in addition to that that you don't recognize, but you pay just the same. Because in many, many industries, at each stage of the manufacture, first the growing or mining of the raw material, there's a tax on that. Then processing it, reducing the mined ore to metal, there's another tax on it. The sale of the metal to the manufacturers, there's a tax on that. And there's a tax on the manufacturer for what he produces. And all these things are added into the total cost of production. It's not separately itemized, it's just part of the price tag on the goods that you buy. But it's a tax just the same, and 35% of your income on the average is being taken for a grossly immoral system of taxation. Now, originally, God was the king of Israel. And the administrative system, the Levites, were his servants running it according to his law. And then there came a time when the people said, we want a king like all the other countries. You'll find this in 1 Samuel 8, verses 1 to 20. And it came to pass, when Samuel was old, that he made his sons judges over Israel. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, and took bribes, and perverted judgment. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said unto him, behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. They didn't say, get rid of these scoundrels, your sons, and find some honest men to do the work. They said, let's do away with this system and make us a king to judge us like all the nations. Remember what God's constant instruction has been? You shall not be like these other nations. I'm giving you a complete new system. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto Yahweh. And Yahweh said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee. For they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherein they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. Now therefore hearken unto their voices. Howbeit, yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. And Samuel told all the words of Yahweh unto the people that asked of him a king. And he said unto them, this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons, and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be his horsemen, and some shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint him captains over thousands, and captains over fifties. And he will set them to sow his ground, and to reap his harvest, and to make his instruments of war, and instruments of his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be confectionaries, and to be cooks, and to be bakers. And he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them unto his servants. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and ye shall be his servants. And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king which ye have chosen you, and Yahweh will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, nay, but we will have a king over it, that we also may be like all the nations. I think I overlooked and skipped a line here. Speaking of this king, they got him, and he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. Now, The 3 1/3% a year for public charity was no burden, and that was not going to the government anyway. That was just being decent and humane. The tax had been the tenth. And Samuel warned them, you will immediately get another tenth on your taxes. You'll pay 20% instead of 10%. And you'll still have the problem of public charity, and you'll still have to give 3 1/3% to that. And in addition, your king will make all these other levies upon you also. Well, at the start, it went up from 10%, or 13 1/3%, to 23 1/3%, and somewhat over. But it's worse than God's warning, because we've let it run till it's become 35%. And part of that is whether you have an income or whether you have none. To take away your home if you don't have an income. So we can see that God's warning was well given. Well, even under this system that God had warned them against, they started out, at least, with merely a doubling of their normal taxes, which you would think would be enough to make them repent. Look at your legislature in Sacramento. They know that everybody is complaining of grossly excessive taxes, and what do? The only thing they can think of is to spend more money, which requires levying higher taxes. If there was anything more satanic than a liberal, I've never run into it. I might remind you to read Isaiah chapter 32, verse 5. He starts out chapter 32 by prophesying how good it is going to be when the kingdom of God is established in all its glory, that is, after the return of Christ. And when he gets down to verse 5, he says that then the vile, V-I-L-E, the vile person will no longer be called liberal. Isaiah knew his politicians. Look at Congress. They know we've reached the point where taxation is an irreparable disaster. And all they can think of is to spend more money and therefore levy higher taxes. Now we're going to have to get back to the laws of God. We never have done it voluntarily. We've always done it in the face of such disaster that nothing else could let us survive. And that's how it's going to be this time, too. But you see, what the good economic laws of God are like and how they would bring prosperity. Just suppose you had no tax whatever to pay except 10% of your income. Remember, the federal income tax alone starts at pretty near double that figure. No property taxes, no sales taxes, no excise taxes, just 10% plus 3 1/3%, no more, for public charity. And all the rest you could keep in your own pocket. When Christ returns, we're going back to that system. But I don't think anything less than his powerful authority will ever get stupid, stubborn people to do the obviously right thing and go back to the laws of God. Now, there's no time to go into present-day economics and show you how things are working out today, or why they're working out today the way they are when we violate the laws of God. Maybe I can talk about that another time. But you are all too painfully aware of what the present-day conditions are, And so you can see that violating the laws of God has been entirely bad. He knew what he was talking about.
This tape was produced by Your Heritage and Pastor Bertrand Comparé. We have much more information in written form and tape recordings, both reel and cassette. We offer this material to assist the personal ministries of those who are called to awaken Yahweh's Israel sheep to the truth of His Word and the necessity for national repentance. Feel free to call upon us for personal consultation. We welcome your suggestions as to how Your Heritage can more effectively spread the gospel of the kingdom. Many people are meeting in their homes using Pastor Comparé's material as the basis for their study. Such groups represent a healthy return to the early assemblies of believers and offers those who finally see the light and come out of the Babylonian church system a place to worship with other believers. We would hope that such meetings would also provide the nucleus of support for a radio broadcast in your area, and we shall be happy to cooperate with you in this regard. As you know, Your Heritage is not associated with any organization. As our congregation, we depend upon your tithes and offerings to pay the expenses of spreading the gospel. We try to merit your support.
Please send all correspondence to our new private zip code, Your Heritage, San Diego, California, 92116-0100. And now goodbye, and may God richly bless you.